does it make more sense just to pay somebody to do it? And those sometimes are hard decisions to make. And that's why I think if you start with that goal in the beginning, at the end, like you have that end goal in mind. And again, it can get a bigger goal or a smaller goal. But if you have that, you generally can work towards something in a more refined way.
Welcome to the Average Joe Finances Podcast. Are you trying to get out of debt? Invest, or just not sure where to start? Then this is the place for you. We discuss different ways to get out of the rat race and build your wealth. Join us on this wild ride to financial freedom.
Welcome back to the Average Joe Finances Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Cavagione, and today's guest is Aryeh Scheinbein. Super excited to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
All right. Awesome. So Aryeh, the first question I'd like to ask you is the same question I ask everybody that comes on this show. And we want to know a little bit more about you. So if you could share a little bit about yourself, share your story. Who is Aryeh Scheinbein?
Okay. So I'm going to try and give you the condensed version. I don't want to put people to bed. The long story short is I grew up in New Jersey and grew up in a great family, but not entrepreneurial minded. Parents very much, hey, we have jobs, we have good jobs, and you go to school, you do well in school, and you go on from there. And so therefore, like by the time I was like in middle school or so, I didn't realize it, but I had a lot of just habits that I had built that were built around business and money and things like that, where it wasn't per se taught. Like I think my parents did a really good job in providing what we needed, but at the same time taught me the value of a dollar. And that we don't just spend willy-nilly and save, invest conceptually. But by the time I was like 13, 14, I played a lot of ball in different sports. I also collected sports cards. And to me, that was almost like a stock market. I would track the players and then track the prices of the cards relative to the player. And I'll date myself a little bit. And that was back then, you didn't have the internet to get an instant price. There was no marketplace of an eBay where you could transact immediately.
You had to go buy those manuals that showed them. Right. Yeah, and that updated every month.
Correct.
Yeah.
And in between the months, the price effectively was stale for 30 days. And you, though, had the ability to understand that, okay, yes, Mickey Mantle was no longer alive. So that card, if that card went up or down month over month or quarter over quarter, you couldn't have predicted that per se. Actually, I shouldn't say that. At the time, Mickey Mantle probably was alive. But the point was, is he wasn't playing, right? There was nothing he was going to do that was going to change something dramatically. But a hot rookie that everybody thought was going to perform and then didn't, or sleeper, nobody knew this guy was going to be great. And then he was amazing. Those cards you could get out in front of and almost like front run the price guide because you had this stale window of time. And I remember this happening over and over again to the point where I'm like, oh, this is simple. My dad would take me to a card show like on a Sunday at one of these hotels, and I'd see a card and I know right away, yeah, maybe it was the dealer was selling it for a dollar and the book already was at three. So typically back then, people would try and sell it for the book value, which was the price guide listing, and they would buy it for half book. That was like models. It's almost like wholesale Keystone pricing, right? Like you go into a retail store, it's $50. That means they probably pay 25. So when you go into the card store, if you wanted to sell your stuff, you knew that you were probably going to get like half book. And so I'd go to a show and the guy would sell it for a dollar. And I know that car was already book value at three. And which told me he probably wasn't up on the fact that this was a performing rookie or an unexpected performing rookie. And I knew that this kid was playing really well. And I felt, okay, next time it could be four or five, just from a percentage standpoint. And so I'd be like, okay, I'll buy all of them. And then if you're right, you can sell them to the dealer later, like any dealer later for half book, or you could do something, trade them with your friend, whatever it was. And so that's a lot of times what I would do. I would then arbitrage it into different things and either flip out of the card or do stuff. And like, I didn't really give it a lot of thought, but by the time I was like 15, 16, renting tables and became the dealer and selling my cars and stuff like that. And what I found though was I'm like, holy cow, I'm behind the table the whole time. I can't really make deals with other deals. I can't go and buy stuff. So then I started having my friends come to the shows with me. They'd stay behind the table. I'd say, the prices over here on this part of the table are negotiable. Over here is nothing is negotiable type of thing. And I would go around trying to find more inventory, so to speak. And
you started outsourcing at 15.
Yes.
Look at that. Awesome.
I wish I really would have leveraged some of those skills earlier on in my career, with recognizing what I was actually doing. Graduated high school, and I immediately think I'm going to be a lawyer. And everybody's like, yeah, it's a great career. And I remember freshman year, I have this professor, and he's like, do you like reading? And I'm like, yeah, I like reading. He's like, no, like a lot. I'm like, eh, I don't know. He's like, the same thing over and over. I'm like, no. He starts giving me basically all the bad things about being a lawyer. And I'm like, no. He's like, you're going to hate being a lawyer. I'm like, oh, okay. So immediately I pivot by the end of my freshman year to go into finance. And it became very clear that like stocks, like I actually had started investing in like mutual funds when I was a little, like 13 to 17. And then like senior year, I think we had a stock market game, but I didn't really fully understand all the stuff. I was like, okay, whatever. Like the money, my money becomes worth more. Sounds good. So freshman year, I started really getting into stocks and the market and understanding business more. And so lo and behold, like that was the path I went. And when I graduated, I was like, okay, I don't want to be a stockbroker. I don't want to do this. I actually interned for stockbrokers. I did the whole cold calling thing when I was like in college. I was like, this is horrible. This is not what I want. And so I did what we call informational interviews. I met with tons and tons of people. And I'm like, what do you do for a living? What is it? Okay, tell me what your job is. Like all the things. And so I got into investment banking. And I was very focused in college that this was the job I wanted. And I was going to get it. And I was going to do well in school. And I was going to focus and I was going to get this job. That was the path that happened. Ultimately, what happened though was once I got this job, I'm like, huh, I'm not so sure how much I love this job, but it was a nice paying job. But I also fell upon sports cards again. And I started a nighttime side hustle and got into buying on one marketplace and selling on another marketplace. So it was effectively arbitraging sealed card boxes. Not just the single cards anymore. I was buying, and then I was starting to buy by the case. And so I would take the cases and you have a sealed case, which has X number of sealed boxes, and I was selling them by the box. And then I started saying, okay, the market was bigger and I got into wholesaling other fishing and camping gear and all these different things. And this is what I was doing at night while running like a full-time big job. And ultimately, when I was doing all this online stuff, I realized, okay, I need to learn marketing and I need to understand customer service and email marketing, all these different things. I started picking up all these other skill sets in addition to the finance stuff. And on my own, though, I was probably doing a lot of financial education in addition to my day job, which taught me about valuing businesses and acquiring businesses and all that kind of stuff. And that's when I just started going deeper and deeper into personal finances and trying to understand anything I could, really. And the truth was, is like in the beginning, you didn't have Reddit. You didn't have the tools today. I tell my kids and people I talk to who work for me, like what you can learn in 12 months today probably would have taken like 5 to 10 years a decade ago or 2 decades ago. Like the unfair advantage of the information, like even this conversation, right? You're in Hawaii, I'm in New Jersey. What are the odds we would, like without the internet, without podcasts, we wouldn't have these conversations. So the evolution of all of this is tremendous. So basically between my side hustles and my day jobs, like I encompassed everything investing, everything business, everything. And so I juggle like a number of things now where I still have for large private equity firms and hedge funds. And at the same time, though, I have a couple of e-commerce businesses I'm involved with, and I help people really understand investing in their personal finances. So it's all these things wrapped into one now.
All coming full circle and all started with that passion for sports cards at a young age. And it's funny because you were doing things back then. Like you said, you wish that you would have known the processes that you were doing back then to apply them a little earlier in your investing career. But I think in the back of your head, it was always in the back of your brain to do things that way. And at the age of 15, to realize to say, hey, at this, I can't go buy cards while I'm sitting here at the table. So let me think of a way to do this differently. And you started bringing in quote unquote employees slash friends to outsource that work to, hey, you guys work the table. I'm going to go find more deals. And by doing that, you were able to scale your little card business deal right there or your table and everything. You were able to scale that up to the next level where you wouldn't have been able to do that if you're just doing it by yourself. So right away, you realize you needed a team, which was huge. The other piece though, when you talk about, because there's a lot to unpack here with everything you just said, but you started off in school and realized, okay, I definitely don't want to be a lawyer just after having this one conversation with this professor. Thank goodness he talked to you right away and got through to you, because otherwise what happens if you would have went down that path and now you're stuck in a job that you really dislike and the other things that you had a passion for might just go away. Like you wouldn't have this side hustle that you're doing at night or have these e-commerce stores, because One, you probably wouldn't have the time as a lawyer to do that. And two, the passion and the drive probably would have just been eaten away. So the fact that you pivoted at that time really helped set yourself up. And I bring this up because I think it's important for people to pay attention to whatever career field you're going into, or if you're in a career field right now that you truly dislike and it feels like it's just sucking all the energy out of you, maybe rethink what you're doing. Maybe get involved in something that you enjoy. So you got yourself involved in finances. Seems like you enjoy that a little bit. I think we all like money. I know I certainly do. So you changed it up. You went down that route and then decided to do the cards again as a side business, as a side hustle at night. And I think that's pretty awesome because not only were you in a good job, but you started doing something else to also increase your income, which in turn gave you more money to invest, right? To build up what you've been building on. And I think a lot of people lose focus and realize that you can still have your 9-to-5 job and start up a side hustle and even get to the point where your side hustle can become your main hustle, right? You can work yourself out of a job. So I think that's important to show that what you were doing during the day, which was a very big job, and you know, I'm sure it was very time consuming, but you still took some time out of your day to do these other things in the evening. So I think that's just something I wanted to point out that I wrote down. And the other piece of that is the other pieces that you had to learn in doing so, right? You had to learn marketing, right? You had to learn all these different skill sets to continue to do and scale your side businesses. So I just wanted to point that out. Now, going into how you got started. So you started wholesaling the sports cards and everything. And then you said you got into some e-commerce businesses. So what kind of e-commerce businesses do you do right now on the side?
So when I first started, it's very interesting where your average person doesn't think about data. You have a conversation with your neighbor, the average Joe, right? Like how often do you say, oh, I studied this data, right? Like nobody, it sounds like you sound ridiculous. But if you really think about it in one way, shape or form, data drives a lot of our decisions and a lot of our thought process. Back when I was starting it, eBay didn't give you granular data. They were starting to have companies like connect to the back end, what we would call like the API to pull the data. But visually, optically, there was enough pieces of information that you could piece together the story if you were paying attention. So when I started on eBay, you could actually advertise on eBay's homepage. You could run your listing on the front of eBay's homepage. And it would, let's say you did a 7-day auction, it would rotate, let's say 3 times over 7 days. And you would see the spike of sales like during that period. What I figured out very quickly was no one is going to pay. It was like $100 for 7 days. No one was going to pay $100 over and over again if it wasn't working. And so therefore, I'm like, okay, this is clearly working because I'm seeing the same things. So now I just need to find how I can buy those things. Because someone else has figured it out. And if someone else can figure it out, I must be able to figure it out. Not because I'm any smarter, but it can't be that I need to be a rocket scientist to figure this out. And so I went and I asked questions, I poked around, and I found this thing. So in the beginning, I was product agnostic. I did not care what I was selling. I just wanted to know that it was going to sell, right? So the data drove that. And then when Amazon became the platform of choice, and then eventually Amazon created this thing called FBA, Fulfillment by Amazon, where I didn't have to do any of the shipping or things of that nature. Then I was able to actually really study data and look at things. And again, it didn't require me and my face to be the marketer. I was just like reselling brands that clearly had demand. And all I had to do was find that brand and find them, have them sell it to me at a wholesale price, and I could resell it at retail price. So now it's evolved. It started out in one thing. The market's changed. I guess the competition has changed. The ability for other people. People are marketing courses around stuff like this. So it's not, nobody knew about this stuff. And so I generally have certain categories that I sell that I have either exclusive relationships with the manufacturer that I am one of one or one of five or less that are allowed to sell their products on Amazon. So we're an authorized reseller. Or we went to the manufacturer. Like a lot of people go to China and they want to manufacture the stuff. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to go to the manufacturer and either make a change to the product or they wouldn't care if they made that product for me with my branding. And a lot of conversations, a lot of understanding different niches and categories. If I told you every type of product I've sold, it's basically anything you have in your house. Like legit. I have for a long time, I was selling toothpaste and soap and deodorant, because that was like, I liked the consumable component, right? Like every 90 days or so, you're going to get a new deodorant or whatever it is, right? And or tube of toothpaste, whatever it is. So all those things, the fact that was going to be repeat buy, And at the same time, it was also recessionary proof. Someone's going to buy a toothpaste, whether it's a recession or not. It was also going to be something that wasn't a luxury. So it wasn't driven by all these different things. But then eventually got very competitive. I moved into sneakers and clothing and like you name the category, I've sold it.
Yeah. And again, by moving into that category, you're also moving to another product that is also recession proof because people still need clothes. They still need shoes. It's little things. It's the things that people need. Now, by being able to move around to these different categories, is that what you mean by being product agnostic? Like you're able to, like you don't necessarily have a passion for or care what the product is. You just know that it's going to sell.
Yeah. So let me take a step back. When I started, I was totally product agnostic. Now I became a little bit more product focused. And because the way I would think about this is if someone's listening, is like, hey, this sounds like a cool thing I want to do, right? There's different models to resell physical products. The way I started, I was literally like buying retail, selling online. And we would call this, like this has a name, it's called retail arbitrage.
Yeah, Gary Vee talks about that all the time.
Yeah, but this was even before Gary was even into this stuff at all. Granted, he was in business, he was doing wine, but it was before he did any of that stuff. But then I got into basically wholesaling, right? Buying wholesale pricing and eventually making it so that I was selling it retail. If you really want to build a brand though, right? So I think of these businesses, okay, like what we talked about, retail arbitrage or even wholesale, where I am not the brand. I'm just literally a mechanism for someone to buy it. I look at that as a cash flowing business. No one's ever really going to come to me and say, hey, I want to buy this business from you. Yes, it could be sold, but realistically, it's all about the margin and the cash flow. And someone says, okay, I'll buy it because you have the relationship, you have this, but I don't own the customer. No one buys from me because it's me or it's the average Joe brand. They're buying because I offer Crest toothpaste at a reasonable price on the Amazon platform and Amazon owns that customer, right? So those are like cash flow things and it's a good way to make extra money and it's a good way to have money to invest. It's a good way to pay extra bills, all that kind of stuff. But if you're like, hey, I want to build a brand, I want to own something, I want to build a company, then you need to be thinking about who is your avatar? Who is the buyer? What speaks to them? So if I wanted to make a money clip, I would probably want some kind of cool bells and whistles that speaks to the average Joe. The average Joe doesn't want it bulky in his pocket. He wants to have two credit card slots, maybe three. What likes the magnetic money clip? What speaks to them? And then I would market it in a way that was like, oh, this is the average Joe. It's not gold and shiny or whatever it is. Or if I'm like, hey, I'm a fitness fanatic, but I can't take it to the gym. What features do I want on this that are beneficial just to the athletic guy or gal or whoever it is who's going to the gym and forgets it or whatever? So if I'm building a brand, I want to know who my avatar is. And then Amazon just becomes a sales channel, right? Like my website's a sales channel. eBay maybe is a sales channel. But the truth is then I own the customer. I have an email marketing. I can reach out to my customer. Whereas on Amazon, you don't own that customer. Amazon owns that customer. So I just wanted to take that step back. When I started Product Agnostic, now we have like our core products that we really sell. We have relationships, some of our brands. So we have two different businesses. One, I think of it like strictly cash flow. And one is more of a brand that we potentially be able to sell.
Yeah, no, that's a great point too, Arya, especially when you differentiate like the difference between somebody who's doing like Amazon FBA versus having your own store and brand where you actually own the customers. One of the things we talk about, at least I've talked about on the show before, when you have an email list and you're doing email marketing and things like that, that email list, you own that, right? That's yours. But your social media, everything else that is owned by another company, that can go away at any time. If you have customers on Amazon, that can go away at any time. Amazon can say, we're going to shut down. We're not going to do FBA anymore. We're just going to do it all ourselves, right? You never know what can happen in the future. However, when you have that list yourself, you own that and you can reach out to people and say, hey, look, I got this new product in my store and whatever. And past all that, both models work. Both, you know, depending on what you want to do. And like you said, for the whole Amazon piece it is more of a cash flow thing, right? But it's also a lot less, I guess, less work that you have to do because you're not the one packing everything up. You're not the one shipping everything. It's FBA fulfilled by Amazon, right? They take care of that. So I think that's pretty nice. It's a good convenience, right?
But now, 100%.
How can somebody, if they want their money or they want to make more money by doing one of these as a side hustle, but they can't allocate a lot of time to that, What would you say would be the best route for them? Or is that like a limiting belief for something in this?
That it could be done or it can't be done.
That I don't have the time to get this done. Because like the way I'm looking at the way that you were doing things, you had your day job that you were obviously very involved in. And then at night, you were able to do this arbitrage and start this side hustle. So how does somebody allocate that time to make sure they can get that done if they don't feel like they have a lot of time?
Yeah, like anything. Whether it's investing, whether it's a side business, whether in the beginning, you have to spend some time learning the skill, right? And like most things, when you start, you probably have more time than money. And then at a certain point, you have more money than time, and you start to buy back more time by using money, like leverage, time leverage, right? Meaning like having employees, outsourcing, whatever. So there's a number of different ways to do this. And I can try and give you like a 3-minute crash course. If you have the cash and you want to start this, right? The one thing is like there are virtual assistants that can help you research in the product. So now there's a lot of softwares and a lot of tools out there that can actually, let's say the arbitrage. There's a tool that will literally compare websites, compare to Amazon. So it'll run through Target and Walmart and whatever, and name any website you probably buy from, and it can price compare against Amazon. You can actually make the search function work to the point where you actually will tell it the parameters. If it's not going to make me X dollars of profit, or it's not going to make me X margin, because Amazon's going to take fees, right? So the software has embedded in it all the fees and it knows all the things. Whereas when I started, they didn't have any of this stuff. So I'll give you like an example. That there's one software out there called Tactical, and that's what they do. Like they legitimately will just run search against it. And for a monthly fee, they'll do whatever you need to do. Now, the next thing you're going to need to do, so you can have a virtual assistant sort through a lot of that stuff. The software is going to run, then someone has to go through the list and say, okay, are there any false positives in the list it gave me? Does this fit my parameters exactly? And all this kind of stuff. And then the next thing is someone actually has to do the buying. So if you're going to online arbitrage, you're going to buy on walmart.com, it has to come somewhere. It can't go straight to Amazon. So now you need either a third-party warehouse who will prep this and then ship it to Amazon for you. Again, all this stuff can be outsourced, but at some point you're going to have to understand what you're doing. And so there is an investment of time, but it can be done in a few hours a night. And the other thing I'd say is like, when people are like, now you told me it's 2 hours and 3 hours and 4 hours, you don't have to do it all at once. And nobody said you have to scale as fast as the other guy. This is like the game's between you and you. Right. If you only need to make $500 a month, or you only want to make $500 extra a month, you totally can do that. And I think that's part of the problem with like physical product businesses, where people get caught up in this, I got to grow. In physical product business, if you're growing, understand, it means it's going to take more money for more inventory. Because in order to sell more product, you have to buy more product. And so if you're like, hey, I want to be taking money out of the business, that's totally fine. But unless you can get like massive margins all the time, you're not going to be able to take money out, profits out all the time and grow the business. Like it's going to be a little bit of an either or. So you're going to have to really focus on what's most important to you. If you, hey, I have $500 a month of bills that I'd love to get covered, it's a layup. But if you're like, I want to bring home a mid six-figure salary, okay, that's going to take a lot more capital to get you there.
Are you a business owner that constantly struggles with your CRM system and keeping in touch with clients? Well, let me tell you about the CRM system that I personally use. It's called HiveMind CRM, and I'm telling you, it's been a fantastic addition to my tool belt as a real estate investor, as a business owner, and as a financial coach. Go check it out at averagejoefinances.com/CRM. You're going to love it. Again, that's averagejoefinances.com/CRM. Real estate investors know they're leaving money on the table every time they pass a rundown property and do nothing about it. Deal Machine lets you and your team pin distressed properties, look up the property owner on the spot, and send a personalized postcard to the owner directly from the app, all within a few seconds. You can set up mail on repeat to make sure you won't forget to follow up. And while the app is sending a custom postcard, you can look up the owner's phone number and email instantly. Plus, if you want to find even more off-market deals, you can build a team of people to drive for you. You just get to track how many properties your deal finders add every day, making your deal finding a scalable and profitable process. Go to dealmachine.com and use the code AVERAGEJOE, that's AVGJOE, for 15 marketing credits during your free trial. That's AVERAGEJOE, AVGJOE.
Let's get back to today's episode.
Yeah, a lot more capital, a lot more time that you'll have to put into that business to build it, right? So it's just, again, it's going to be at the operator's pace, right? Mm-hmm. How fast you want to scale, how fast you want to do things. And if you're trying to build something up to get rid of your day job, obviously you're going to want to put that time and money in upfront and make that happen so you can sit back and do something else that you enjoy. Kind of what I was talking about earlier, right? If you're in a job field that you don't like going to work and it's not something you're passionate about, and you want to start up a side business to do something different, if you focus and you put enough time and effort into that and money, you can build something up to replace your day job and do something that you enjoy, right? Something that gives you a little bit more satisfaction, job satisfaction, work-family balance, work-life balance, and all that. I think that's huge. Okay, cool. Now, what about if you're trying to grow your wealth? Now, a lot of people, they'll get involved in a business like this, and sometimes they'll lose focus, right? And they just focus on scaling and scaling, and sometimes forget about everything else that's going on. So what happens to somebody that gets in a situation like that, where you lose focus and you forget the whole reason why you're in the business in the first place?
Yeah. So there's so many different ways we can go with this, but like the most important thing, like you were just saying, right? Like, why did you get into this, right? Was it to generate an extra $500 or $1,000 a month, or was it to replace your day job and you wanted to move to this full time? And even if you move to this full time, have you scaled like from an operational leverage standpoint, meaning do you have virtual assistants, do you have employees that can do a lot of the things without, like you made the mention of it when I was at the card table figuring out that I couldn't be in two places at once. It's the same thing. Like I joked when I first got into FBA, like I met a lot of people and a lot of these people left corporate or they left the job making, I don't call it $75,000 to $100,000. And they were able to bring in $75,000 to $100,000 of net income to themselves from this business. But they were working like four times as much or three times or two times as much. But they loved it because they were working for themselves. So I would always say to them, like, you don't have a business, you have a job, you work for yourself, you're self-employed. And that's cool. But just understand that, because if you take the next month off, guess what's going to happen? Your income is going to fall apart. To your question, right? Someone who gets into this and now they're like, oh my goodness, they don't have time. That you need to constantly be reassessing, like, okay, what am I trading? What am I giving up? I have four kids. So my whole thing was like, I wanted to coach their sports leagues and I wanted to be with them when they were going here or there and whatever. We want to go on family vacation. So I needed the systems and the people if I was going to walk away from that and like for a week or two on vacation while having my day job, like I'm allowed the vacation there, but could I do that on the side things? So I think one of the things that I learned really quickly was, okay, I want these businesses to throw off the money to either pay for certain extras that I didn't want to change my lifestyle for, or really invest the capital. I want to be able to do more real estate. I want more money going to the S&P 500, whatever it is. And that's how I start to think about it. And like the truth is, whether you do it as a side hustle or full-time, whatever, you need to treat it as a business. And like I always say to people, like you really want to start with the end in mind in the beginning. What is that end goal? And the goalposts can change. Like the goal's allowed to change, but you should be reassessing that goal. And I tell people, like, if you want to talk about business, not on the investing side, but just on the business side, there's two really good books that just think about. And that is, one is Built to Sell. It's a 200 page or less book that it's written as a story. And it's not about selling your business. It's about building that business to have the ability for it to be sold. And the other one is Revisited, right? Like Michael Gerber. And it talks really about, hey, you're this person, you're doing all the things. And now the business doesn't grow because you are doing all the things, right? You're this bottleneck. And so again, both those concepts are the same in the sense, like at the core, they're like, think about the end first. So if you got into this business because you wanted to build your wealth, then you need to know that every month you want to take X percent or X dollars out of the business and have it auto pull to the S&P 500 mutual index fund or ETF or whatever it is. Or if you want to be buying Bitcoin on a consistent basis. Okay, fine. You're going to dollar cost average it. Whatever you think your investment strategy is going to be for long-term wealth, use this business as a tool to do that. But if you lose sight of it, you'll likely get trapped in this, lack of a better word, hamster wheel, like constantly chasing, because there's always more money to be made. Like, why do you want the money? So I know it sounds like cliche. Oh, what's your why? But the truth of the matter is, like, sometimes you want to save $5 and you want to make $20. But really, if that's going to cost you an hour of your time, is that really worth it? Does it make more sense just to pay somebody to do it? And those sometimes are hard decisions to make. And that's why I think if you start with that goal in the beginning, at the end, like you have that end goal in mind. And again, it can get a bigger goal or a smaller goal. But if you have that, you generally can work towards something in a more refined way.
Yeah, no, Arye, that's a very fair way to put it. There's a couple things here, right? You're talking about moving the goalposts, right? Yeah, you need to have your goals. You need to have it set somewhere and you need to chase those goals. But eventually, you're going to have to change them because you will achieve those goals, right? You keep pushing and pushing, you're going to achieve those goals. Then what? You don't want to stagnate. So you want to keep moving the bar. You want to keep raising the bar. And this goes two ways, right? You don't want to get yourself into the point where you're on that hamster wheel, just constantly chasing and chasing if it's not something that's attainable. But if you set these goals and you keep chasing these goals and you're attaining them and you move the goalposts further and you keep going and you have a good reason why you're doing, then you'll be unstoppable because you'll be able to just keep growing and scaling and making that happen. Now, the other piece of that, as you're saying too, don't lose focus as to why you did this. You were doing this to generate wealth, to replace your 9-to-5 job or whatever that case may be, whatever your goal is for doing it, whether it was to make that $500 a month to pay off some bills or $1,000 a month, whatever it was, don't lose focus of what that was and get solely invested in that you lose your way. And then on top of that, as you're doing this, especially if you're doing this to build your wealth, take money out and invest it and make sure it's getting contributed into something. So you said into the S&P 500, or if you're going to dollar cost average Bitcoin, whatever it is that you might want to do. So let's say somebody is in their 9-to-5 job. They started their side hustle. They're investing that money separately into some index funds or just into own individual stocks that they're comfortable with. Would you say that contributing to their employees' 401k, does that still make sense while they're still doing this on the side?
Yeah. So I think my view is personal finance has the word personal in it because everything's personal, right? So obviously the answer, disclaimer, it depends, and this is not financial advice. But if your company that you work at is giving you some sort of match, so everyone's got these different things, but like on average, they'll basically say, if you take 6% of your salary, they'll give you 3% of your salary in a match. So that's effectively a 50% match to your first 6%, right? So let's talk in easy numbers. If you make $100,000 salary, you put in $6,000, they will match $3,000. Out of the gate, there's not a question. You just got a 50% return on your money. You should put that $6,000 in because you just made 50% on it, even if you're flat in the market. So total no-brainer there. And even if you're going to grow it in a business, it's still 50%. That's a number. And so like the other thing is now you have to start to look at your personal situation. 401ks, really, like whatever, they're 40 years old. They're not like, they haven't been around, maybe they're like 50 or 60 years old, but they haven't been around for decades and decades and centuries. They replace the pension fund because the companies are like, we can't keep investing and create a future for these people. So you got to do it on your own. And they come with all these tax things, right? Like pre-tax, post-tax, right? Because it was Roth 401ks and then there's regular 401ks. Keep in mind, most importantly, anything in this vehicle, for the most part, you cannot touch till you're 59 and a half. Yes, you can take it out. There's penalties, all these things. But the reality is like, you have to know your situation to say, okay, is this, am I okay waiting till 59 and a half? Or do I want to be doing something else with this money, right? I want to save $10,000 so I can go into a real estate syndication where I'm going to own a piece of land with my next door neighbor or whatever it is, right? And worst comes worse, you take it out and you pay the penalty, right? That's probably like the worst case scenario. I guess the worst case scenario is you put it in your 401k, it drops 50% in value, and then you pay the penalty. Okay, so obviously not that good. Putting money in a 401k is definitely still something that people should be considering, but understanding like what are they really trying to accomplish? Because that money at 20 whatever years old, it's going to compound really nicely, right? If you fill it from like 20 to 30 and you do your 18 and whatever the heck it is now, $19,500, $20,500, whatever the legal tax allowed amount is, if you're going to put that in, it's going to compound really nicely. Yeah, you'll have down markets, you'll have up markets, but it's going to grow. But if you're like, okay, I want to do this other business, again, I go back, hey, do you have a match? Take the match. But after that, if you're like, no, I now want to grow this thing and start a new job, like create enough of a business that maybe I'm going to even leave my job, I have no qualms of putting it into a business because one of the best investments anybody can make is investing in themselves. So understand there's the long, short way and there's short, long way. And what that means is if you think there's going to be some sort of shortcut here, guess what? You're going to hit some roadblock because you didn't know something. And it's a lot cheaper a lot of times to pay someone to learn. Yeah, you can go on YouTube or listen to podcasts. I'm not opposed to any of that stuff. And I'm not like mandating everybody pay for education. But a lot of times it shortcuts things because you didn't know that thing hiding behind the wall, or you didn't know that, If you go this way, guess what? There's another tax to pay on the back end or something like that. So in terms of, like, if I want to be investing in a business, I say, yeah, put the money to work if you have a match. If not, you have to make that short-term decision of, like, how much do I need to be growing this business or to educating my, and then can I afford then just to put the rest or some of it into the 401k? Because the reality is, this is another principle I tell people, and that is Parkinson's law, which has nothing to do with investing, is something that holds true in anything. Parkinson's law in its short form is whatever time or space you give something, it will occupy that. So if I give you a closet to hold your stuff, you'll probably be able to fill it up. But if I actually give you a whole bedroom, over time, you'd probably fill the whole bedroom up. Or you have a project due and I give you 3 days and normally it takes you a week. You're going to get it done in 3 days because that's only the amount of time I gave you. If you make $5,000 a month in post-tax money and I say, and you're like, I spend all of it. Like I use every penny of it. So I can't afford to invest my business or my training or my education. Parkinson's law will hold true. And that is if I take 10% away from you to put into your future and invest or put into your future to give you education or whatever it may be, you'll find a way to live off of $4,500 a month. Now, it's not like Dave Ramsey cut the latte kind of thing. It's you'll find a way. It will maneuver itself. And that's a Parkinson's law concept in my mind. And it may have been a long-winded answer to the simple question, 401k or not, but I think it really depends on the situation, but those are a lot of the variables I would think about.
Yeah, I absolutely love that answer because, again, a lot of great takeaways from there, especially the one about shortcuts. Like if you ask me, cuts lead to deep wounds, right? You take a shortcut, it might seem like a shortcut, but man, it's really a deep cut, right? Because a lot of times you're not going to see the stuff that's going to catch you off guard because you decided to take a shortcut instead of doing it the quote unquote, the right way the first time. And real estate, we call that an expensive education, right? Because you're going to learn from that, yeah. Hopefully not do that again in the future. But yeah, that's all great points. And especially with Parkinson's law, using that as a reference as well, because you're going to have to learn to work around what you have and what you're given. So by taking that 10% away and working around, eventually it's going to become normal. And that's what you're going to be used to doing. It might be difficult for the first 30, 60, 90 days, but after that, you're going to be like, oh no, this is what I live off of now. It's $4,500. No, that's all very key points and key takeaways. Okay. Awesome, Arya. I'd love to transition this into something that I call the final round. It's where I'm going to ask you 4 hard-hitting questions just to get a good sense of who you are when it comes to being under pressure, making mistakes, and all of that good stuff. So if you're ready to go, we'll get this party started.
Let's do it.
All right, let's do it. All right. So Arya, the first question of the final round is, what's the biggest mistake you've ever made?
I don't know that there's the biggest because I have a number of mistakes I made. I made a lot of mistakes. And I think we're going to stick on the topic of either investing or business, go with that. And I think it was
stick on the business side because I have a lot of investors that come on the show and share their biggest mistake in investing. I'd like to know what your biggest business mistake was.
So the biggest business mistake was for all the push that I gave against manufacturing something abroad in China, I was very opposed. I felt like I had no advantage because I don't have boots on the ground. I'm not there. Even if I were to go there, I don't speak the language. Like I feel like as a US, you know, person, it says sucker written all over you. Like you're there to be taken advantage until you have the relationship. So I was very opposed. And so for a while I wouldn't do this. And eventually I had a business partner and I was convinced that this was going to work out and the product was going to sell and everything was going to get manufactured great. And sure enough, we didn't fully understand some of the components that they told us in terms of what the fail rate of the manufacturing was going to be. And we sunk a bunch of money into a product that in theory should have sold well. The data said that it would sell well, but the quality control was atrocious. So now we've sunk the money in. Then we had to pay to get the thing out because now it's sitting on the docks and they're going to charge you rent or whatever it is. You can't just dispose of it. So we had to boat it over here. Then we paid someone to sort through what was good and not good, then paid to dispose of what wasn't good. And then ultimately, instead of trying to sell it on Amazon or whatever, we literally sold the quality ready stuff to another seller just so that they could potentially make money. So we got hit every which way, right? Like I paid for the product. I paid to get the product out. I paid to have the product basically combed and half of it destroyed. And then I took some lesser amount for the product. What I learned from that mistake was bad. And it was compounded by go with your gut, right? Like my gut said, never do this. And eventually the money, the idea that we're going to do so well convinced me otherwise. And it was a big mistake. And I should have said, I know what I know. I know what I don't know. And I don't need to try and do this thing. And ultimately, it was a failure.
Yeah. Wow, Arya. So it's like one of those situations you got blinded by the potential profits of that. And you were like, oh, this can be a really good thing. And it made you forget about the whole reason why you didn't want to do that in the first place. So
yeah,
I definitely appreciate the honesty and being so transparent with a situation like that. That was pretty rough. Again, an expensive education that you had.
Exactly.
It's definitely something you learned from and realized that your initial gut feeling, you were right. And to not do that. Yeah, always trust your gut. A lot of times you can have all the data in the world pointing the right way, saying, this is going to be good. This is going to be good. But if you get that pit in your stomach when you think about what you're about to execute, it might not be the best move to do. That means there's some type of self-doubt on the inside that is telling you, hey, don't do this. So, oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Definitely appreciate that. So the next question kind of ties into that, right? And that is, what is something that you've learned that you wish you knew when you first got started?
Okay. So a lot of things I wish I knew when I first got started, but I'm going to tie two together. And that is, time flies and you never get time back. So that's one. Like time, when you lose, when the time goes on, you'll never get it back. And it seems obvious. And it seems obvious. What's so great about that? But you always think that you'll get it. Meaning, let's just take a for instance, I was at a job, I was working at a venture capital firm. And for those number of years, that employer did not offer. Okay. And what I should have been doing was using the IRA for those few years. It was 3-4 years. And I told myself, like, oh, it's okay, I'll make back the time. And the reality is, like, when you're young, those years matter a lot. And like, mentally, I kind of knew that. But in practical application, you just didn't feel it. You're like, oh, it'll always work out. And so I wish I knew that, no, you won't get that time back. No, don't make that sacrifice. Don't do that thing that you think you'll shortcut it later, right? Like, you'll find a way. And so therefore, just know that, like, when you're in your 20s, do the thing now, because you're not going to have time later to do it. If you don't have time now, guess what? You're not going to get more time later. Your life's going to get busier. Different things are going to happen. And so take those chances. It's hard, whether it's investing in business, career, it's hard. Like, I get it, but that time is never going to come back.
Yeah. Wow. Great point, Arya. And it's one of the things too, is like I had mentioned earlier, that work-life balance, right? You need to have that, because if you just work, you're gonna lose the other piece of your life and the enjoyment that you get out of life, right? So that's huge. It's one of the reasons why I retired from the military at 20 years instead of staying in longer. I felt kids were at an age where they were 18 and 11. I'm like, I need to be home more. I need to be able to provide but still be the attentive father that I need to be for my children. So yeah, that's huge. So definitely that self-recognition of time is not something that you can ever get back. Even the time that we've spent talking to each other, I'm glad this for me at least, it's been a very fruitful conversation. So it's something I can't get back, but at the same time, it's something of value. So I value this time that I've had with you to talk about this. Absolutely awesome. All right. So I have one more hard-hitting question, and then we'll get into one more opinion-based question. And that is, do you have any tips or tricks that you would recommend to someone that is just getting started today? Let's keep this on the arbitrage side, rather, if somebody's starting up a side hustle.
Okay. So I think this cuts across everything. This doesn't matter. Investing, side hustle, big business, regular business, life, marriage, anything. And that is, stay consistent. And it's one of these things where, again, sounds totally basic. Of course, we got to be consistent. But no, it's not. If you are doing arbitrage, okay, let's use your example. If you're doing arbitrage, it's very easy to say, hey, I bought on Monday, I bought product on Tuesday, I bought product on Wednesday, I'm going to take Thursday and Friday off. But you're heading into Q4, right? We're coming out of the summer. No, you need to be building that inventory. And the model says, buy inventory every day. And if you're like, hey, I want to grow my podcast. No, you need to post on social media every day. You need to record that episode every day, whatever the cadence is, right? So maybe on the arbitrage, it's buy one day, ship the next day, label the next day, whatever it has to be done. Don't break the consistency, because what will happen is the income will break. And same with investing, right? Like, hey, dollar cost averaging. I'm not going to automate it. I'll remember, right? Oh, boom. I'm not consistent. If you want to stay healthy or you want to work, stay consistent. All these things, it's just like this truism that, like, we take for granted, but if you actually start to monitor your consistency, in all these things, you'd be like, holy hell. Like, it's one of these crazy multipliers that you're just like, okay.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's just great life advice in general. Yeah, no, love that. Now, I have one more question for you of the final round. And I will preface it by saying, besides your own, because we'll get to that. But besides your own, do you have a favorite business, investing, or real estate related book or podcast or both? And I already know of two books that you mentioned, but is there any others?
Yeah, sure. So I read a lot of books. So I could ramble a ton of books, but I will say—
just not reading them over and over again.
So there are certain books, though, that I have read multiple times. There are certain books, and they're not investing books. So for example, I'll give you a book that won't count for your one, but Atomic Habits. I've read that book more than one time. And it's because it, again, was a consistency thing. But I would say if we're looking for basic investing books, there's a book called The Richest Man in Babylon. And it's not about investing.
I love that book.
But
one of my favorites.
It is a favorite book because, again, it's a parable. It's a storyline. It's easy read, but it talks about the power of compounding. It kind of frames everything from an investing kind of perspective. So I think that's a very, very good book. The other books, it's interesting. Like if you're like, but I want something stock related. I want something like really investing. I would say the two books I would tell people to read are The Little Book That Still Beats the Market is one. It's a quick book also. And then I think it's called The Little Book That, I forgot. The other one is written. So that one's blue and there's a red one. That's The Little Book That it's about index funds. It's written by the founder of Vanguard, John Bogle. So I'm blanking on the exact title, so I don't want to mess it up. Those are good investing fundamental basics. Like someone who knows close to nothing, these books will explain things in a very 10 to 20 year old range. Very easy concepts and that kind of stuff. So those are two books there. The Richest Man in Babylon is just like a general book that I think for that investing in just money is a very good thing. There's a new book out though that I would tell people to read, and that's The Psychology of Money. And that is a really good book. It's out in the last 2 or 3 years. Excellent, excellent book. I'm blanking on the author's name. But again, read it and I can highly recommend it. And it will probably change the mindset of a lot of people in just how they invest or think about money.
Yeah, absolutely. So mindset's a huge thing, a key thing too, especially when you look at some of these books that help you with that mindset. Even The Richest Man in Babylon, it's one of those things that just, it's a foundational book that when you read it, it's even if you had no knowledge whatsoever of investing or being able to save money properly or how to do that, it will give you those guiding principles all through little short stories and parables. And it's really written really well. And
agreed.
Absolutely love that. It is actually my absolute favorite personal finance book. When people ask me, it is my favorite. And then of course I like Rich Dad, Poor Dad as well. But that one right there just takes the cake for me. Richest Man in Babylon, 100%. Okay, awesome. Glad to see we have that in common. All right, let's get to the juicy stuff, right? Because people listen to this show and saying, man, I really like what Arye's doing. He's got some really great concepts. He's talking about some really good stuff. I want to know more about him. First of all, let me mention that he has an Apple Top 100% ranked podcast called Inside the Lion's Den. That's the first thing I want to mention. Yeah, so if people want to find more information about you and your podcast, do you have a website, social media, anything like that where people can follow you and get more information?
Yeah, the website is solutionadvisory.com. Or if they want like basic investing finance kind of stuff, you can head over to futurefundme.com. And then social media, Instagram is the platform I'm the most active on currently, which is Arye the Businessman. And Twitter, I've been getting more active on, which is just my name, Arye Scheinbein.
Awesome. I love it. I will make sure I have those links in the show notes to make it easy for everybody to find that information. Just don't sit here and try to click or copy and paste it if you're driving. All right. Now, hey, this has been an awesome conversation. I genuinely appreciate it. Thank you so much for taking the time today to chat with me.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it as well. And I'm sure we could have just continued for another few hours. So
I think we could, 100%. All right. Hey, thanks for joining me and our special guest, Arye Scheinbein, on the Average Joe Finances podcast. Don't forget to go leave us a 5-star review and tell us what you liked about this particular episode with Arye. Aloha from Hawaii and have a great rest of your day. Thank you for making it to the end of this episode. Greatly appreciate you being here with me today on the Average Joe Finances podcast. If you haven't done so yet, make this the episode that you go leave us a 5-star rating or subscribe to our YouTube channel. The Average Joe Finances podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only. Have an outstanding day.
Thanks for listening to the Average Joe Finances Podcast, your source for beating debt, saving money, and investing. Learn more at averagejoefinances.com.